The dangers of global warming are overblown, and the solutions most passionately advocated are off the mark. So says Bjorn Lomborg, who also argues that polar bears are really doing fine and Al Gore is going too far. Well, we'll see how much he sticks to those ideas today when he's my guest. Controversy greeted Lomborg's 2001 book, The Skeptical Environmentalist, in which he argued that many environmental problems were overblown. Major critical battles ensued with the Danish Committees on Scientific Dishonesty and Scientific American, among many others. Since then, Lomborg's commentaries have appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Globe and Mail, The Guardian, The Daily, and Sunday Telegraph, and The Economist, and he's appeared on CNN, BBC, CNBC, and PBS. In 2004, Lomborg was named one of the world's 100 most influential people by Time magazine. He's an adjunct professor at the Copenhagen Business School and the director of the Copenhagen Consensus Center, where he strives to devise economic solutions to the world's pressing problems. Welcome, Bjorn Lomborg.
Hey, Tara. It's great to be here.
Your PhD is in political science. What led you to focus on the environment?
Well, it was really a very odd story. I mean, I was totally content being an academic and doing very obscure things with game theory and statistics. And I also wanted to make university a better experience, so I actually organized off-course things for my students. And one of them was I read an interview with an American economist saying things are actually getting better with the environment. Now I'm an old Greenpeace member and, you know, left-wing worried kind of guy, and I thought, got to be sort of right-wing American propaganda. But, you know, he said one thing that really annoyed me. He said, go check the data. And that's what I always tell my students. So I figure, all right, I'll go do that and I'll debunk you. And I actually brought along my students and we decided to try to debunk him. You know, we were pretty sure we were going to debunk him. We would just have fun in the process. As it turned out, he was a right-wing and he was wrong sometimes, but much of what he said was right. And that's really what got me into this discussion. We need to have a conversation about what are the real numbers. It doesn't mean that there are no problems. And I think, as you just said, there is certainly a better world to be had out there. But we need to have a conversation about how do we actually reach that in the best possible way.
Well, it's interesting. In that answer, you answered two of my upcoming questions. One was that when you titled your first book, The Skeptical Environmentalist, speaking of yourself, my question was, and you can add to it now, was what were you first, a skeptic or an environmentalist? But it sounds like you were an environmentalist first.
I was definitely an environmentalist. That's sort of, and I think it wasn't something I gave great thought to. I think most of my generation, certainly the people that I know, are all just sort of inherent environmentalists. We feel that the world was coming at least somewhat to an end and that we were doing all the wrong things. I remember we had a right-wing government in the 80s in Denmark, and I was incredibly annoyed with them for some of the things I felt that they were sort of letting go of the world. So I totally know that sense, and that's, of course, the background for what I wrote. But the skeptical part is, I hope, something that everybody should be, but often we're not. I mean, there's lots of things we don't have time to be skeptical about, but I think it's incredibly important we are, because if we don't get the right information, if we don't get the sort of right sense of proportion, it's unlikely we make good policy judgments.
Mm-hmm. So you remain both.
Absolutely. I mean, I have never owned a car. I go around on a bike all the time. I'm actually vegetarian, mainly for moral reasons. I don't want to kill animals, but it also has a huge environmental impact. So, I mean, definitely, I want to be good to the environment, but I also want us to have a conversation about how do we do that. And I also, of course, want us to make sure that we care about all the other problems that are out there, like huge burden of disease and the lack of, you know, the amazing poverty that we see
right
throughout much of the world.
Right. Given that that book aroused so much controversy, and it was written in 2001, Skeptical Environmentalist, which means you actually, it came out in 2001, which means you actually wrote it probably in 2000,
yep,
7 years, which is, you know, an age nowadays. Have any of the positions you took or analysis that you came up with then, have you been surprised by anything in either direction in the intervening years?
Yeah. Of course, there are things that we now know that we didn't know back in 2000, 2001. But I think the overall and very comforting fact is that because most of what I looked at was 150-year time trends, the last 7 years didn't do very much, because these great systemic efforts, it's basically the story of saying that mankind do tend to solve a lot of the problems. Yes, we throw up new ones, but we do tend to solve more than we create of new problems. And certainly what we've seen is, for instance, both in quality of life, but also in environmental issues, we have generally gotten better and better as we've gotten richer. If we just take apart the climate change issue, which is special in that sense, we have pretty much cleaned up much of our act. Clearly, back in the 60s, you know, rivers would catch on fire, and that was certainly not the way the world was meant to be. But we also then rallied ourselves, and I think that was great. That was part of the big achievement of the environmental movement, that we actually said, we don't want that. But even if you go before that, there was many of the environmental impacts that are probably even more important that we already cleaned up starting in the early part of last century, simply because, you know, a huge amounts of pollution is also a waste. And so when you got more aware of that, you actually cut down. Take London as a good example of air pollution. We've seen London, we have data back from 1585 for London air pollution, and it got worse and worse and worse up till about 1890. But air pollution in London has actually declined since then pretty continuously, so that today the London air is cleaner than it's ever been since medieval times.
Let me jump on one thing you said. You said that as we get richer, we tend to handle some of our environmental issues. And what I assume you're saying there is that if there's, let's say, a hierarchy of needs, that when you are struggling for mere survival or living in abject poverty, the environment doesn't even show up on your screen. Yep. I know that Mark Hertzgard in his book Earth Odyssey talks about China, where the pollution was just so incredible because it just wasn't on their radar screen. Yet, as we've gotten richer over these last few years, it seems that in the U.S. for sure, in many of the wealthier countries, that richer has not been at all equally divided. That what the most of the richer in the developed countries over the last few years has gone to the upper percents and not spreading as much. Does that confound that analysis?
There will always be that political discussion of how you should distribute your wealth within individual nations, and it's probably true in general in the rich countries. We've seen an increasing inequality. It's important to say global. We've actually seen a dramatic lowering of inequality because we've had millions of people lifted out in China and India. But yes, that's probably true in the U.S. and certainly also in Denmark, for instance, where I come from. But the overall point here is, you know, to remember this is a 20 or 30 year time frame that I'm looking at. And the idea is even the poorest, if, at least as long as they also get richer, and certainly they will over a 20 or 30 year time frame, that means that you simply are more willing to give up some of your resources, perhaps not for such identifiable goods as food or education, but also to get a cleaner environment. And that's, of course, the key. If you're a poor peasant in Brazil, you're going to slash and burn rainforest, even if it only feeds your family for a couple of years. But if you're rich, you'll stay in Rio de Janeiro and be a web designer.
Right. Let's move to the new book, Cool It. Why did you write Cool It?
Basically because this is, in many ways, the big environmental discussion now. Everything has been subsumed under climate change. And it seems to me that there is a need to stake out the middle ground, certainly in the U.S., but also elsewhere. It has been unproductively been a discussion between, oh, it's a hoax. No, it's a catastrophe. With the right wing is typically taking the position it's all a hoax. It's a left wing conspiracy to raise taxes. Whereas the left wingers, certainly led by Al Gore, will say this is a planetary emergency and the potential for human survival is at stake over the next 100 years. And again, I would say these are vastly exaggerated points, both of them. It's not a hoax, but it's not a catastrophe either. It's a problem, and one of the many ones we need to fix in the 21st century.
Let me jump in on that, because for so long, and I'm somewhat repeating you, some have made the argument that climate change is not happening, or if it is, that it's not due to human activity, but you don't ascribe to either of those.
And let me just put that in plain words. Global warming is happening, and it's caused by man. It's caused by a burning of fossil fuels emitting CO2.
Now, it's interesting that you say that, because what I would have assumed that there were cyclical changes in climate to which one would not be able to say it is caused by, but to say that we are contributing to what perhaps might be cyclical.
And again, I'm simply saying this because I want to get out of this hoax of catastrophe. Of course, there's an underlying natural variation, and we are overlaying on that and a warming trend. But again, most of these cyclical behaviors are probably on many centuries, and that's why it makes sense to say we're actually changing the environment in half or a full century. And so we need to have a conversation, to what extent should we stop doing that?
Right. And if that's so, then – and it's interesting. I mean, I think what we're finding out is areas of agreement here. If that's so, that no matter how critical our contribution to climate change might be, it is in some sense the only contributing factor about which we have control.
Well, I mean, yes, clearly, immediately. There are also people pointing out that in the longer run, and I think we should definitely be researching those issues, there are other ways that we could also imagine changing the parameter of changing the state of the thermostat, if you will, of the planet, you know, micro mirrors in space sulfur particles in the stratosphere or a blooming of the oceans, so that kind of thing. But
in
yes,
other words, you're saying there are some things that we might be able to do to mitigate even the parts we aren't contributing to.
Yes.
But to go back to the point that I was making, it's that
That's not what my book is about.
Right. And since we have control over that part, it seems to make sense that we do our best to confront, mitigate, delay, et cetera.
Yes.
We're in agreement on that. Okay. So, and that there are other good reasons, it seems to me, with the coming of peak oil whenever you place that, the pollution of oil beyond climate change, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, although you have to be more careful about those arguments because they don't just work in one direction. It's clear that we'd like to have other energy sources than oil. But, of course, what will happen if peak oil indeed comes around, and clearly it will at some point, although I probably disagree on it coming anytime soon, but when it comes, it simply means that we'll go back to coal, which is, you know, there for hundreds of years, and clearly, for instance, for the Chinese, very easy to dig out of the ground. So it's not clear that simply because
we run out.
In other
words, don't equate oil with fossil fuel.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
But then the it seems to me the things that we would do, which would be conservation, efficiency, renewables, all of that, you would be.
And we also have to remember carbon capture, which is unlikely to not be a big part of the solution, basically that you can use coal, especially let the Chinese use all their cheap coal, but capture the carbon and store it safely underground. And possibly we also need to talk about both fusion and fission.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we should allow ourselves to have all these in play and think about, you know, I think it's very hard to know what's going to be the silver bullet or what are going to be the best solutions in 50 years. So let's make sure we research in all of these areas.
So in other words, a concerted effort, a more than just business as usual, but a real, you know, I mean, I'm going to use the Manhattan Project or the Apollo Project kind of a thing to boost renewables, boost efficiency, boost conservation.
Yes.
You're in agreement.
Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. Let me ask you then a bigger question about the climate change thing as opposed to other problems.
Yes.
And since now we've gone away from that, but originally when you answered why you wrote Cool It, is that you want to put both our preoccupation with confronting and dealing with climate change in context with other problems we face, like poverty, disease, et cetera.
Yes. And that's one part of the discussion in the book. And I think it should be one part of the discussion that we have as a civilization, is to say, what do we want to be? How do we want to be remembered? Al Gore talks very much about climate change being our generational mission. And I'm simply curious as whether our coming generations, our kids and grandkids, are really going to look back on us and say, wow, that was really smart, granddad, if we, for instance, do the Kyoto Protocol. The Kyoto Protocol, well, if everybody actually did it, which they don't, but if everybody did it, would cost about $180 billion, yet only postpone global warming by 7 days at the end of the century if we just do it within these 5 years that it was allotted. If we continue to do it all the way through the century, it'll postpone global warming by about 5 years at the end of the century. So it's fairly little at fairly high cost. And I'm simply curious as to whether that's what our kids and grandkids are going to think most highly of us, when we could, for instance, the UN estimate that for half that amount of money, or less than half, we could solve all major basic problems. We could give clean drinking water, sanitation, basic health care, and education to every single human being on the planet. I think they might think of us slightly higher if we did that first.
Let me go in just a little further to what you said about the Kyoto Protocol, which no one's, I don't think, coming close to meeting. I mean, maybe there are a couple of countries that are, but it's almost quirks of where they were when the measurements, when the benchmarks were set, right? But if most, if in the aggregate we're failing, and you're saying that even if everyone accomplished what that said, which was rolling back wherever we get to, back to 1990
a
levels
little low,
or percentage,
a little low,
yes, that would only, even if we continued that percentage, that
even if we kept that low target for the rest of the century, which would, of course, be more and more restraining as we got richer and richer.
Right.
So
got more and more populous.
Yes. So this would be a fairly strong argument. We would only postpone global warming 5 years by the end of the century.
Okay. So then let's shift off of making it a choice between Kyoto Protocol and handling disease, education, and hygiene, and so on. What could we do to actually make a real dent rather than a several-year dent in global warming?
And that's, of course, where I talk about investment in research and development. I would much rather see us focusing dramatically, as you said, almost an Apollo project, although I don't think it need to be as expensive, but invest in research and development in non-carbon-emitting energy technologies or low-carbon-emitting energy technologies. Basically, the idea is right now people want to cut emissions, and that's what everybody talks about. Now, it makes us feel all warm and fuzzy inside, but of course, it actually is fairly costly and, as we talked about with the Kyoto Protocol, will do very little good. Instead, we should be thinking about how can we invest in research and development so that cutting lots of tons become very cheap for our kids and grandkids, and not only for them, but also, of course, for the Chinese and the Indians, who won't do it otherwise if it's not very cheap. So invest in research and development on renewables and solar, wind, and all these others. And you know, to give you the metaphor, right now, solar panels, which are only going to be part of the solution, but just allow me the metaphor. Right now, solar panels cost probably 10 times as much per energy as fossil fuels. That means rich people in rich countries will put up a few to show how good they are. But poor people in rich countries won't. And obviously, most Chinese and Indians will not, because they have much more important issues to deal with. What we need to do is, instead of just going on and say, we need to have more people put up solar panels on their rooftops and spend gigantic fortunes in getting subsidies to those, we should invest in research and development so that these solar panels become almost as cheap, or imagine if we could actually make them cheaper than fossil fuels, then we wouldn't have to have this conversation. People would simply take them instead of fossil fuels because they'd be cheaper.
Hmm. It sounds like whether within the climate change solution arena or within the problem-solving arena, you seem to phrase things as zero-sum games, that we should be doing research and development rather than I'm naive. Isn't anyone that's taking this problem seriously gung-ho for both?
Yeah. Obviously, everybody would say we should do all things. And clearly, in a world where we have 26 civil wars, we should be solving them. There's 15 million people that die from easily curable infectious diseases. Clearly, we should save those. There's 3 billion people who have lack of micronutrients, or 2 billion people without clean drinking water and sanitation, 1 billion people without electricity. The list really honestly goes on. And of course, we should solve all of those. I'm for it. We'd solve everything. But clearly, we haven't done so.
And let me just throw
half,
in, by the way,
50
that
centuries.
The U.S., the wealthiest nation, I saw an estimate yesterday that's including current and future costs of $700 million a day on the war in Iraq.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You can look at both where the money could go and where it is going. Both
yes,
are problems.
But of course, my point is to say that most people would not funnel that money into doing good in the world, because that was not the intention in the first place. This is just like you can say we spend $1 million on saving one human life in the U.S., which could probably save a whole village in Zambia. But we don't, because we're, bottom line, mostly egotistical. But I simply talk about, to the extent that we spend money, and we probably spend about 1% of our GDP on doing good in the rest of the world, we should at least have a conversation about how we do it. So you're talking about this is a that I see this as a zero-sum game. Well, no, I'm happy if we could get more resources to all of these areas. But I still say, if, imagine, we get another $50 billion to more to spend on doing good, wouldn't we want to spend that in the places where it would do the most good and not just spread it evenly on all of these so we'd spend some at really good projects and some on rather poor projects?
Okay, let me approach that again. In these, I think there's two different arenas. One is the within climate change and one is the larger context. Within climate change, do you believe that there are people who are saying, just cut emissions, don't invest in renewables? I mean, who are you arguing with on that?
Very, very clearly, if you look at the Kyoto Protocol, there is nothing about investing in research and development. And actually, all of the Kyoto countries have seen declines in levels of investment in research and development. And so the point, and I'll tell you why, because the Kyoto Protocol is a short-term treaty. And so all it does is it doesn't encourage you to think about, oh, how are we going to solve this problem in 30 or 50 years? It encourages you to think, how can we get around this over the next 5 years? And that very often turns into tactical things.
Wouldn't another way of putting that be, how can we stop doing worse? In other words, the Kyoto Protocol says we're heading in the wrong direction. Can we put up a signal big enough that we will stop making things worse?
Well, but the point is, what it does is it forces people, to go back to the solar panel metaphor, it forces people to invest more in inefficient solar panels now to solve the problem right now. Of course, a tiny fraction of that amount, at least in principle, ought to go then to research and development. But in reality, we don't actually see that in our numbers. And of course, secondly, because you're only thinking about the next 5 years, it makes most people think even more about how can we change the accounting system or many of these other things, or can we buy something from China just to tide us over? So the outcome is that people overall focus on cutting emissions right now and have very little regard on investing in long-term research and development. So I would say this is not just, I mean, I'm sure if you ask someone, they will say, oh, we should do both, we should do everything.
Right, but what you're saying, when you look at the actual numbers, the result since the Kyoto Protocol was passed by as many countries as it was, 155 or something, that the overall investment in research and development has decreased.
Yes. It's decreased since the early 80s, actually. And so that's why we need to say we got to get back on a smarter level.
Okay.
And so, yes, of course, in principle, nice people will always say, if you say, shouldn't we do both? And they'll say yes. But of course, at the end of the day, it is a question of saying, no matter how much money you have, if you had spent it all on one instead of on half on both, you would have done better if you'd spent it on the smartest of the two
strategies. Let's go then to briefly, the argument that you make where you compare climate change to other things.
Yes.
And let me see. You said, and I'm going to quote here and tell me if I'm right here. If the $1 billion in malaria, $1 billion spent to combat malaria, does more good than $1 billion combating climate change, and assuming the next $1 billion will do the same, you would argue, shouldn't we then have a conversation about perhaps spending both billions on malaria and none on climate change?
Yes.
But doesn't the kind of root problem that I believe climate change to be, that is, that it affects so many other things, whereas malaria is in some sense a more isolated problem, not to that village perhaps or that person.
Sure.
But shouldn't a root problem that has tentacles and repercussions and ripples all over the place, shouldn't that be treated differently than what I would call an isolated problem?
I would first take issue with the isolated point of this, because obviously malaria affects huge swathes, about 500 to a billion people. And the point is, these people are also going to be much more vulnerable to climate change. So if we do something about their malaria, it just doesn't mean they stop dying from malaria. They get much richer, their societies get much more resilient, and therefore they'll be much better able to deal with the impacts of climate change. So we got to have a conversation about how do we best deal with this. But of course, it would be silly of me to sit and say the only thing we should ever do in the world is only malaria, because obviously there are many other problems in the world. And likewise, we should also think about how do we deal with climate change in the long term. term. But I'm simply saying investing in short-term solutions like the Kyoto Protocol or cutting right now will both be poor investments for the world and actually do fairly little for these people who are also suffering from malaria.
Okay, let me ask one last big question, and we've really got about a minute and a half, okay?
So that's the right time for a big question.
Yes, and that is that I say at the start of my show that it's about a world that just might work. And when people ask me what that means, I say that I hold a worldview that reality is not dead, it's not mechanical, and it's not separate, but it is alive, evolving, and in composed of interdependent systems. Is that fairly much the worldview you see?
That's a very hard question to answer in this short amount of time. But I think what we have seen certainly is that we have a civilization that's able to deal with many of the problems that the world throws at us. And so if we've learned anything, it really is that our crucial resource is our ingenuity to get out of future problems. Now, we solve problems, we create problems, but overall, we actually, unfortunately, solve more problems than we create, and our ingenuity is the one that we should be focusing on, hence the investment in research and development.
Do you know Thomas Homer Dixon's work?
I know
the ingenuity
gap, and then
the upside of down. And he first wrote the ingenuity gap, saying, you know, maybe our problems are too complex and too large that we've outraced our ingenuity, and hopefully not. And then his latest one, he says, maybe we won't actually make the big changes we need to make until we hit the wall.
Yeah, and of course, there's a lot of people out there arguing that that's the case. But if you look at it in reality, climate change is one problem. And it is an issue that we'll need to face, but it is one we'll need to face over the next 50 years. And it seems unreasonable to me to assume that we won't actually deal with much of this. Again, with the sea level rise, for instance, yes, sea levels are going to rise a foot, which is about what they rose the last 150 years. And we dealt with it. It's not even on the radar screen things that happened in the 20th century.
That's sort of a best case scenario, isn't it?
No. The UN says it's between 1.5 and 2 feet.
You know what?
Yes.
Right as we get into the numbers,
no,
we've got to go. But that's okay. In other words, that's all the time we have. So again, the book is Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist's Guide to Global Warming. You can learn more at Lomborg, LOMBORG.com. And so there you can see what he says about the numbers. And thank you, Bjorn Lomborg.
Thank you, Terry.